Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Midwest Beat. I'm your host, Tom Lounges. Today I've got some very special friends in studio with me, Chicago radio legend Mr. Mitch Michaels and local book author Ken Shirola. Together they have authored a great new book called Doing the Cruise. We'll talk about Mitch's career, we'll talk about the making of the book, and a little later in the program we've got Dr. Sandy Kapoor, a doctor to the stars. He's got a brand new book out as well, and we'll be talking to Benny Turner, the younger brother of blues legend Freddie King and a great bluesman in his own right. Benny's going to be inducted into the Chicago Blues Hall of Fame coming up in just a few weeks. We'll talk to Benny, Dr. Kapoor, and of course Mitch Michaels and Ken Shirola kicking it all off. But right now, here's a song that kind of sums up Mitch Michaels' career. Life is a Rock. A lot of name dropping going on in this one, just like in his book. This is the group Reunion. Mitch Michaels and Ken Shirola join me live in the studio after this.
Be Bumble and the Stingers, Martha Hooper, Rachel Singers, Lonnie Mack, Twang and Eddie Hisman, Ring, we're going steady, take it easy, take me high, lie, lie, house of fire, no commotion, poker, passion, deeper purple, satisfaction, baby, baby, got it, give me, getting hotter, Sammy's cooking, Leslie Gore, Richie Valens, end of story, Mahavista, Fujiyama, Kamasutra, Rama, Lama, Richard Perry, Spectre, Barry, Rogers, Archers, Nielsen, Harry, Shimmy, Jimmy, Coco, Poppin', Fats, back and finger poppin'.
Life is a rock, but the radio rolled me, gotta turn it.
Simon, the A-holder, Rolling Stone, and Santa Folder, Johnny Cash and Johnny Rivers, Cancer, now I got the Shivers, Mongo, Jerry, Peter, Peter, Paul, Apollo, Mary, Mary, Dr. John, the Nightly Tripper, Doris Day, and Jack the Ripper, got it, Ghost of Goddess, what a Leah Russell, give me Sheldon, Miracles, and Smokey Blizzard, Sly Guitars, the Fender Bass, and Mushroom, Mumlin, Bonnie Bramlin, Wilson, Pickett, stop and kick it.
Life is a rock, but the radio, life is a rock.
Jay and Thalen, Ronnie, Kukla, Fran, and Norman, Oakland, Denver, John, and Osmond, Donnie, J.J. Kalen, ZZ Top, and LLB, and D.D. Donna, David Bowie, Steely Dan, and Sing Me Proud, C.C. Ryder, Edgar Winter, Junior, Summers, Isaac, Marcus, Johnny, Thunder, Eric Clapton, Peter Wallace, Steve LaFosta, Doodah, Doodah, Good Vibrations, L.B. Ronda, Surfing Girl, and Little Honda, Tida, Tida, Honey, Honey, Sugar, Sugar, Yummy, Yummy, CBS, and Warner Brothers, RCA, and all the others.
Life is a rock, but the radio rolling, gotta turn it up.
Life is a Rock, and Mitch Michaels rolled it out in Chicago on just about every major station in the Windy City. Mitch Michaels has a brand new book called Doing the Cruise, Memories of a Lifetime in Radio and Rock and Roll, co-written with my good friend Ken Shirola. Both of them are in studio right now. Thank you for coming down and making the cruise.
Thanks for having us.
We
appreciate it. Although I do need to maybe set a couple of ground rules real quick.
Okay.
The reason that Ken has a muzzle and a leash on him is that he's a very, very aggressive author, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he has attacked and bitten several interviewers. So please be careful what questions you direct towards him. Also, he's very sensitive about the glare on the top of his head.
Oh.
Don't, you know.
Lucky it's radio.
youngest guy here, you can't least
see,
amount of hair.
You can't see the glare at the top of my head because I'm a tall guy. So it's like that helps.
Mitch, I remember you coming to Point East all the time.
Oh, sure.
We had all you guys out there.
Absolutely.
Sky Daniels, you, yeah. Patty Hayes. I mean, everybody used to come out there and host shows. And I was so enthralled with the fact that I grew up listening to you guys. And, you know, I was just breaking into radio back then. And the fact that you guys are all, well, most of you are still doing it. And you're still doing it. You're on the river now.
Absolutely. You know, and I get periodically somebody goes, well, are you thinking about retiring? I'm like, why would I retire? I'm doing exactly what I always loved. I have the greatest schedule in the world. You know, I'm on the air from 3 to 7. I leave my house about 1:45. I get to the station. I'm on at 3. I'm out of there at 5 to 7, and I'm home before 7:30. It's like,
right.
It's not a lot of heavy lifting, okay? It's, you know.
What was it that actually got you interested in radio? I'm always curious as to what jump-started someone's career.
There's a story in the book, and I was going to college. I was going to Kent State, and literally heard a commercial as I was driving home that said, do you hate what you're doing? Did you just flunk a test? I had just gotten a rather unsatisfactory return on a midterm. And it was an ad for a radio school. I'd always been interested in sports, and so I checked into this thing and kind of followed up on it. And my dad was a real big education guy, really, you know. Got to go to school, got to get your degree, got to, right. You know. So I, to try and get this handle, I went, you know, the smart route. I went to my mom, you know.
God bless mothers.
She got on board and she helped me talk him into it. And there was a radio school in D.C. was actually the closest place. So I agreed to pull out of school for a semester and go to this place called Career Academy. And spent 4.5 months in D.C. At this radio school, and actually happened to get a job at the station that a bunch of the instructors worked at towards the end of the term as well. So
now you got your first professional start at MMS in Cleveland.
No, actually, no? My first I worked as an engineer in Cleveland at WGAR, and then found out their FM was going to go live in the summer of 1970. Submitted a tape to the guy that was the new PD, and he hired me to do mornings. Now think about that. In 1970 on FM, mornings was not a desirable other than all nights, this was probably the second least desirable shift you had.
Right.
You know?
FM wasn't what it is today.
Well, no, not at all. I mean, you know, and this was freeform progressive radio that had just started about a year and a half before, not even a year and a half before that in San Francisco with Tom Donahue, KSAN, in like probably November of 1968. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we went on the air there and, you know, we had some disagreements with management about 3 or 4 months later, and so we went on strike, and of course we weren't union, so right. It was like hasta la vista, baby. Then I worked at another station in Cleveland, then I worked at MMS for a little while as well.
Because MMS is the one that I always remember hearing that you started at. That
well,
was like
yeah,
the jump point.
That was my buddy had just gotten fired from there, and I just had left this other station, and so I said, you mind if I go over and apply for the job they just kicked you out of? He goes, no, go ahead. So I was there for just a few months, kind of a gap filler.
Cleveland is the birthplace of rock and roll with Alan Freed and the old Moondog
Matinee
shows. And,
absolutely.
Of course, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is there. Do you ever get back there? Do you ever?
I do. Okay. My oldest daughter and her whole family live there, so I get there a couple times a year. And I actually finally just got to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. I was very negligent about that. And,
were you impressed with it?
You know what? I was in the sense of some of the things that were there. My line was, you know, you can only look at so many guitars and so many Beatles suits.
Right.
What impressed me were the videos. The videos they had in almost every area, and it was, you know, scores of them, were extraordinary. There were some really, I mean, they had a great Alan Freed thing in there that was a tribute to him. But they had Hendrix. They had just everybody you can think of. And one of their moving displays that they were just plugging in was Rolling Stones' 50th anniversary.
Oh.
They had every cover, and some extraordinary pictures of, you know, artists, and some great video from that as well. So it was
It was Springsteen. They had just opened the spring. And yeah, I guess Mellencamp is the guy now that they're doing a special exhibit on. Mm. How did you guys meet, Ken? I mean, you're a kid from Highland. I've known you since you were in high school. You've got a book that you had put out a couple years ago about a cancer survivor.
Right.
You've done radio yourself.
Yeah, Mitch and I have run in a lot of the same circles.
Okay.
And oddly, we almost worked together. There was probably a couple of month gap there where Mitch had left CKG and I came in.
You plugged in there, right?
And so we almost hooked up working there. But running in the same circles, in radio circles, we have a lot of mutual friends. And Mitch was out with, I believe, Big John Howell.
With Big John Howell.
And Joe Campisi.
And our buddy Joe Campisi, right.
Okay. And Joe is a friend of mine. He was an AE sales rep for me at CKG. And Mitch had been talking that he was thinking about doing a book. And my first book had come out. And Joe's like, hey, I know a guy that writes.
I got the guy for you.
I got a guy.
His name speaks for himself and how he speaks as well. It's like, you know,
and,
Campisi.
Yeah. So he hooked the two of us up. We met at the infamous York Tavern.
Absolutely.
And kind of talked things through. We figured out that, you know, it was a good marriage and went from there.
So how did this book, Doing the Cruise, Memories of a Lifetime in Radio and Rock and Roll, come about? What was the impetus for the two of you sitting down and saying, let's put it down?
Mitch wanted to get his stories out before he forgot them.
That was the whole deal with that was I had several friends that, you know, over the years I'd tell a story and, are you writing any of these down? You're going to, I said, no, you know, one of my buddies, an attorney who'd written a couple of books that were probably 6 or 8 inches thick, mm-hmm. you know, law books, had said, you got to write this stuff down, man. This is, you know, so I said, okay, let's talk about that. The best part about that is, and I've used this line, Ken kind of laughs at it as well. My memory was pretty good. I really didn't have a lot of blanks or whatever else. And I've said, you know, as much stuff as I've ingested, snorted, rubbed, drank, immersed myself in, or had somebody else rub on me, mm-hmm. my memory was pretty doggone good. So it was like, it was surprisingly so.
Right.
We basically just sat down and I said, I really want to do a memoir. So we, you know, kind of went from the beginning and, you know, bingo.
So, Ken, how did you what was your reaction when he said, I want to do this?
Well, you know, we had talked about it, and all kidding aside, you know, Mitch has been around for some great, not just Chicago radio stories, but some real rock and roll history moments stories. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and we'll get into this in a little bit, but, you know, I mean, Mitch plays an integral part in Rod Stewart's career that you may not know the name Rod Stewart without Mitch. So there's a number of those kind of things. And as we talked and me having the background in music that I've had, mm-hmm. And then radio, I could truly appreciate them. And they're just some great stories. You talk about, you know, again, Rod Stewart, Disco Demolition, Journey, Chicago Fest, which was big for Chicagoans and Northwest Indiana. I mean, because we're considered Chicago. Right.
And
Chicago
the cover of the book is a picture from that.
Yeah. And I'll let Mitch talk about that. It's just a great, great shot.
It's you're in the thick of the throng there.
That was summer of 1979, Navy Pier, and the Loop booth was probably about 8 by 6 and was probably raised about 3 steps up. It was plywood, had a little plywood fence around it, and then on top of that about a 2-foot piece of plexiglass, so, you know, a little protection. And I would go out in the crowd. We would have we started broadcasting at 10 in the morning. I'd get there at 2. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we had 5,000, maybe 6,000 people around this booth.
That's crazy.
And remember what Navy Pier was. Mm-hmm. It was a 2-story Quonset hut. It was just that. They had the metal tin roof, and it was so hot in there. It was August, and it was just – so I would wear a T-shirt and a pair of shorts down there and maybe some flip-flops or something, and I'd have like maybe a pair of silk shorts on underneath. Well, it got to be 4 o'clock. It got pretty warm, and I'd start taking my clothes off, you know.
and you didn't have much on to start with.
Plus the fact there was a lot of really attractive young girls down there, too.
Right.
It was like, you know, I'd go out and do breaks out in the audience and stuff like that. And this was a shot that Bill Sosin just took it over the edge of the booth and shot it right down into the crowd. And it does kind of capture the moment and the essence of Chicago Fest.
I miss Chicago
Fest. Oh, I do too.
None of the other festivals can touch it.
No.
Ken, you were too young for that.
I don't remember Chicago Fest. I remember you actually telling me about it from years before, and then obviously through Mitch hearing about it. It sounds so awesome. And actually, there's another great Chicago Fest story in the book with Mitch, with Billy Idol, of all people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Alice Cooper was the headliner on the main stage. And the way they had it set up was so weird because the main stage was right up
in front
where you walked in.
Right.
You know, all those other great little stages, which was really cool. But Alice was the headliner, and Billy Idol was the opening act. And I was the MC for the show and brought Billy on. These people were hardcore Alice Cooper fans, all right? And Billy got into about his second number, and these people are yelling and screaming and throwing stuff at him. And just, I mean, not just a few people. There was, you know, this was an avalanche, and it was really obnoxious. And he cut out after about the second song and just walked off. And I went out there and just lit these people up. I was just like, what the – is the matter with you people? You don't treat somebody like that. That's just ridiculous. This is Chicago. Show some class. I said, if you guys want to throw something at somebody, I said, here, throw something at me. I said, I'll tell you what, anybody that thinks you're man enough, meet me at the back gate. I'll be back there waiting for anybody who wants to take a shot. Okay.
Wow.
So I went back to the back gate. Of course, I had like four guys with no necks who each weighed about 400 pounds standing next to you. And nobody showed up, thank goodness. It was like.
And the brilliant part of that is if you look at the cover, Mitch might have weighed 120 pounds.
Oh, no. I was 6'3 and I weighed about 175. But, you know, it was like still, you know. But it was just one of those, oh, yeah? Come on.
Did Billy come back?
No.
No.
No. No.
Wow. I remember a similar situation, although I did not go on stage and do what you did. It was at the Aragon, and it was the Loverboy. They were an unannounced guest on the Jim Carroll band. And
okay.
I think it might have been Boomtown Rats or somebody.
Okay.
They didn't fit.
Yeah.
And they came out in their red leather, and people pelted them with like beer cups.
Yeah.
They got three or four songs, and then they left, and that was the first night I ever heard of Loverboy.
Yeah.
So,
and as you know, I was a huge Loverboy fan growing up.
Yes. Well, I'm intrigued with this Rod Stewart story. And again, there's a lot of stories in the book. It's called Doing the Cruise, Memories of a Lifetime in Radio and Rock and Roll. And besides the rock and roll stuff, there is some great personal stories and revelations in here as well we're going to get to. But tell me about Rod Stewart.
Well, that's a story that extends over a bunch of different years. Started 1970 in Cleveland, working at WNCR. We got passes to this festival in Michigan, Goose Lake. So I was the guy that drew the long straw and got to go for the weekend. And I'm there, and Rod and the Faces were playing, had some pretty good access, had a chance to talk to them a little bit. They were, you know, I mean, this is 1970, so I'm talking to Ronnie Wood, I'm talking to Rod Stewart. I was a big Rod Stewart fan already. The first two albums that he did, the yellow one with Handbags and Glad Rags on it. And then the second one was even more.
Gasoline Alley?
Yeah, Gasoline Alley. We were playing those, and I knew him from the Jeff Beck group and that stuff too. But so it was interesting to talk to him. Move forward about a year, 1971, he comes to town with the Faces, and he's touring on Every Picture. And the single was Reason to Believe. And we were getting all kinds of calls for the flip side, which was Maggie May. So I'm backstage at the show, and he remembered me, which was really a shocking part of it. You know, this tall, skinny kid with long hair and bell bottoms, and you know, didn't know his ass from a hole in the ground. And he remembered me, and kind of we spoke for a little bit. They went out and performed. He came back, and we talked a little more. And I said, you know, the album's amazing. I love it. I said, you know, the single's great, but you know, the flip side is really getting a lot of attention. He goes, well, why don't you jump in the limo with me? Come back to the hotel, I'll buy you a drink. So we went back to the hotel, had a cocktail. I told him, I said, Maggie May is the song. He went his way, I went my way. I mean, it became a hit. I didn't really ever even think about it after that, okay? I saw him about 4 years later. There's another Rod Stewart story from 4 years later that I won't get into, but I saw him at an album party for Atlantic Crossing about 4 years later. We didn't talk about that, whatever else. Now jump ahead, actually 22 years. springtime, May, June of must have been June or July of 1993. Jay Leno had just taken over The Tonight Show. He had Rod on. Rod sang a song, came back. They were talking, goofing around, and Rod switches seats with him, and, you know, they're really having a lot of fun. And then Jay goes, all right, so you're going to sing another song for you. You're going to sing Reason to Believe, right? He goes, yeah, that was the flip side of Maggie May. And Rod goes, well, actually, no. He said, actually, Maggie May was the B-side, the flip side of Reason to Believe. He said, but if it hadn't been for this disc jockey in Cleveland who flipped it over, he said, I might still be digging graves. And I'm like, I'm watching this with my wife. We're sitting in bed. And I'm like, oh, I said, he's talking about me. I can't even believe. I know he would not remember my name. I'm sure if he saw me today, he wouldn't even remember who, you know. Oh, yeah. How are you? But it was like, wow, it blew me away. Wow. That he remembered that. And that was his reference from, you know, from 22 years before. So it was like, you know, hey, I've made jokes about it on the radio. I tell that story a few times. I went, geez, you know, Rod must have lost my address. I'm not getting any of those checks. It's like,
you know, everyone that's in this business, Ken, yourself, myself, we meet a lot of celebrities.
Absolutely.
And most of them are pretty nice people. Mm-hmm. Some of them not so nice. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to dish any dirt, but who would you say are among the nicest or the best memories that you have working with?
I have a couple of very special ones, and they're not even really, well, sort of music. I had a chance to spend about 45 minutes or an hour with Mel Brooks. They had him touring on all the goofy songs from his movies. I think it was on Elektra. And they brought him around. He only did about four interviews in Chicago. But I got a chance to spend almost an hour with him. He was not only hilarious, he was just delightful. What a really nice man and just funny. I mean, just as crazy funny as you would expect, even more so.
It's hard to interview comedians.
Well, it is. And I, you know, it's funny. I mean, there was three other people that interviewed him, and I listened to some of them, and they were trying to be funny with him. I'm feeding him straight lines, and he's just hitting one right after another out of the park. It was like, I'm not trying to get, you know, even close to this guy. I just want him to, you know, let me lead him in, and he can take it out. He was terrific. Another one that I remember is Bette Midler. She came through, was at the Loop, and she was doing interviews for The Rose, the movie, which I absolutely adored the movie. That was her first movie, and she got an Academy Award nomination for it. She didn't win, but and she was absolutely spectacular, just nice as could be, and very warm and open, and you know, and I'd been a fan of hers to a certain extent, you know, her music for a while, you know. She was just absolutely a delight.
She's very bawdy, but she seems like so much class.
She didn't come off bawdy at all, and it's so funny because, I mean, that movie was so Joplin-esque and whatever else. But she was just really, really, really nice. And the funny part was, like, the next day she was on with, I think, with Roy Leonard. And he was talking to her, and he goes, well, he goes, you know, how do you like Chicago, you know? And she goes, you know what? I've met so many nice people here. Yesterday I was over at the Loop, and that Mitch was the – and Roy's trying to change this story. Because Wally Phillips is in the hallway going, they said the Loop. What? Steve Dahl? Is he here? What? It's like
– oh, man.
Crazy stuff. So, yeah, those are two. There's many, many others. You know, I mean, there's a lot of really nice.
There's a lot of name dropping in the book.
Well, you know, I mean.
Because that's your life.
It is. It is. Yeah.
Ken, what about you? I mean, other than Trickster.
Yeah.
He's out. If you no Trickster, he's out. Yeah.
No. I have encountered a celebrity or two in my day. As you know, I mean, my writing career has spanned longer than I probably care to admit at this point. I'm over 25 years, so breaking in with
but
the guys.
But you started really young.
Well, and this is fun fact. Tom actually landed me my first writing gig at a little magazine in Indianapolis called The Call Magazine.
I remember that.
And doing album reviews and whatnot. And then Tom and I worked together on The Beat Magazine when Tom relaunched The Beat in 92,
something
3,
like that.
1, somewhere
you
in
know,
there.
The one article you did that I always remember, if I forget every other memory of you, I will always remember, you were the one that broke in our area and with me, a young lady named Shania Twain.
Yes.
Never heard of her. Mm. And you said, you gotta let me write on this girl. And I always wanted, when I went to Vegas, she was doing a residency, I always wanted to say, you know, our magazine really broke you. Yeah, right. Call Ken.
Yeah, right.
That's our Rod Stewart where we didn't get there the checks that we, were, yeah. Hey, we deserved. Yeah.
The checks, yeah. Checks didn't show up at your door either.
Right.
Talk to your mailman, will you?
But you know, I mean, everybody from Poison, you know, I was very close with Poison, did a lot with Poison over the years. In the glam era, Poison, Warrant, Bon Jovi, Motley. And then into country, I got into country in the early 90s. And thankfully, like, you know, timing just worked out because that was the break of, you know, the class of 89 was just starting to come through with Travis and Garth. And the editors that I was working with were like, you know, I'm going to interview so-and-so. You talk to this new Chesney kid or whatever, this Martina woman. And, you know, and then having, you know, going on through there all the way till now, I still own and edit This Is Country Magazine. I still do a lot of work with artists in Nashville. You know, some of the older artists, and then I work with some of the newer kids, like this kid Preston James, who's 17 and just lighting it up.
Are you still doing radio?
I am. I'm not really doing radio anymore.
He's doing radio.
I'm
right
doing
now.
Radio.
Well, that's true. Yes.
Right now. But yeah, my radio days probably been about, I don't even know, 6-7 years, I guess, since I've been out of radio. And I've been focusing on my writing and. Pretty much that.
The magazine is still going.
Magazine's still
going.
Where
do you get it
at? Well, it's a I partner with radio stations across the country, smaller market stations that don't necessarily have a lot of access to artists because they're so small. That I do. So a lot up and down the East Coast, everywhere from Florida all the way up to Olean, New York.
Okay, Mitch, why was Ken the right choice to have as a co-writer?
Everybody else turned me down. No. you know what? It was funny. I had talked to a couple of other people, and when Ken and I sat down, I kind of threw out what I was thinking a little bit, and we probably had, what, 3 or 4 sessions together just talking about direction and content and things like that. And it seemed to click. It seemed to it felt comfortable. You know?
I call that our dating period.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
How long was the process to write it from the time you met and said, let's do this, to the time it rolled off the
press? 2 years.
2 years?
Yeah.
That's actually pretty quick, considering.
Yeah, and it could have gone quicker. We met once a week. So we would meet once a week for anywhere from 3 to 5 hours, and I would interview him. More like a therapy session. He would lay on the couch.
Yeah, it was a lot of catharsis. Of course, you see that in the book,
right?
Too,
but right. Like,
and then I would go home and write, and you know, keep up. And there was a lot of things that.
Did you send him like proofs and dailies?
Oh yeah, he would send me like monthlies or every 2 weeks or something like that. And I go, this is good. No, this is
we change and fix.
Got to change that name to protect the innocent.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, and then you know the funny thing is, you know, and I'm sure you can attest to this, when you start talking. And with Mitch, this starts literally from his childhood and goes all the way through. So as we would talk about things, it would trigger something like, oh, my gosh, well, there's this. And sometimes we would jump. So we might jump, you know, like we're talking about a Foreigner story in, I don't know, I'm going to make up a year, like 1972. And then he's like, oh, and then there's this thing in 78. So he would tell me this, and then we'd have to backtrack, and then we'd get it to the 78 part. And he's like, oh, then there was this part in 75.
He's making notes going, okay, I got to circle this because this goes with, you know, that kind of stuff.
So but,
you
know.
Did you record as well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we recorded everything.
Yeah. To protect the innocent. But it was a lot of fun. And when you look at this behind the scenes stuff, and even in radio, you know, and that helped too, I think, with our relationship is that I knew radio. So when we're talking, I kind of knew some of the nuances, like, well, what about your producer or what about your, you know, your news guy? And he's like, oh, you know what? Now that you mentioned that, so it kind of, you know, unearthed some things that might have gone, you know, unnoticed.
One of the things about radio and writing, and Ken, I think I told you this when you were young, that you gotta have a nomadic soul. You have to go where the jobs are, and you have to get used to eating ramen soup and mac and cheese a lot because the jobs come and go. Mitch, you've jumped around Chicago stations a lot, but you've stayed in Chicago, which is kind of rare.
It is.
That you stay in one city.
People ask me about, well, where did you work? My line is I've been fired from most of the good stations in town, some of them more than once. But, you know, I just got lucky a lot of times where, you know, I get popped someplace and there'd be something going on down the street or, you know, something else was going on. There was a period of time there, and I probably brought part of it on myself. When I left CKG, I sued them because I felt they breached my agreement with them. And that litigation went on for about 8, 9, 10 months. And the judge stopped the process and said he wouldn't let Tim Sabian come back and testify and whatever else. So we stopped it, and he put a cap on the judgment. Still a decent judgment, but that probably did the old blackball thing with me for a while. I didn't work for anybody full time for quite a while after that. So
did you leave the market or stay?
No, I was still here. Yeah, I mean that was 93, 94. I mean, I worked at WLS for like 3-4 years as production director, and then I went briefly back to the Loop, and then went to 94.7 when it was WXCD and worked there for 4 years. But after that, it was pretty sparse times for a while.
How did you land at the River? And are you happy? Is that going to be your place that you retire?
I just celebrated 6 years there the day before yesterday, as a matter of fact. And that's 4 months from being the longest employment I've ever had. So, you know, let's they can't hear us up there, can they?
Oh, they can on the stream, yes.
Damn. Wait, your PD's calling me right now.
Yeah. Tell her I'm busy. You know what? At this point in time, you know, I'm certainly not interested in going somewhere else. Mm-hmm. You know, New York's calling, LA's calling. Been to New York, been to LA, maybe not doing radio, but been there. It's like, nah, you know.
You've been doing the gig for so many years, so many decades now, and just like with the press and the media, with newspapers, they're all saying radio's dead because we've got Pandora and we've got online this and we've got that, and, you know, all this technology. What is your thought as an insider who's still doing it? Is radio still got a future?
I think it's got a future in a certain extent, and I think it depends that future's in the hands of some people who really need to think about how they're programming stations, what they're doing. I think the live and local aspect of radio really has a place still. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't get that from any app, any Pandora, any Sirius or XM or whatever else. That is lost, and that I think still is important. I find that a lot of people still relate to, you know, either me or, you know, me talking about music or mm-hmm. whatever else on a local level. If I'm out at a show or doing a remote or something like that, people appreciate the fact that you're talking about a show that happened, you know, 20 years ago here, that they REO, were at. This, they were at. Or, yeah. And you're not only does the music revive a memory, but your little, you know, insight into something that happened there adds to it. So I think that part of it, people still really, you know, they yearn for that. In fact, I think they yearn for it more. And sadly, a lot of these program directors and consultants don't get it. They don't understand that that's where they can really focus in and, you know.
Well, that I left commercial radio for that very reason.
Yeah.
No more telling stories. No more this day in history. Mm-hmm. No more fun. Mm-hmm. In other words, just that was, this is, and here's that same song you heard yesterday.
Hi, I'm fill in the blank.
It's exactly. So are you seeing that? Are you having a little more freedom at the River? Are they giving you that?
They give me the freedom in the sense of expressing circumstances with music, and I set some things up ahead of time, you know, so I can, you know, dates, times, birthdays, you know, this guy, this and that, whatever, you know. So I have that opportunity. It's like, you're on the clock. You got 22 seconds here, and you get the weather in there as well. Make sure you do the calls at the beginning and the end, and blah 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 boom. It's like that I don't have to deal with. So fortunately,
that's one of the reasons I came to NPR. Yeah, the freedom,
right?
To be able to be creative a little bit.
Sure.
We have a caller actually that wants to say hello real quick. Right. Is he on here? Mike Nowak. Hey, Mike.
Hello. How are you?
Mike, how are you?
Let me ask first, am I getting feedback from the radio?
A little bit, yes.
All right, it's going off.
Turn your radio off, sir. Thank you.
That's an old thing we used to say back in the day.
Turn your radio down, please, sir. That takes us back, right?
Yep.
I said, Mitch, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well, sir. How about you?
I'm doing. When I heard that you were going to be on the radio with Tom, I gave him a shout out and wanted to say hey. I wanted to congratulate you on the book.
Well, thank you.
You're your writing partner there. I can't wait to get my hands on a signed copy of it.
I can't wait to get my hands on a signed copy of it either. He keeps taking them out of my briefcase. It's like, you know.
Well, I imagine you're walking, riding around with a trunk full, ain't you?
I wish I was.
Not today.
Not today, sadly.
So
they're all gone. You're waiting on a second publishing.
We're waiting on another order to show up, right?
What's your favorite memory of Mitch on the radio?
On the radio, I wanted to ask, first of all,
okay,
were you in the Daves with Patty Hayes?
Are you asking me if I ever slept with Patty Hayes? Is that what you're asking?
Oh, no, and I'm still looking for her boots under my bed.
No, let me tell you something. I worked with Patty, known her for a long, long time. The one problem that I had with Patty is I never wanted to be on the air or even in the same room with a woman who had a voice deeper than I did. So I was like, you know.
Amen.
It's like, you know, come on. She had a great voice. But
she had a great rock and roll voice.
She also smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, too. So, you know.
I know I worked at the Ambassador East Hotel at the time, and every noon whistle, I'd be up on the roof at the lakefront there listening to Patty Hayes and enjoying lunch.
There you go.
You contact with her still or no?
You know what? She's a Facebook friend. She lives in Michigan. She's been out of radio for a while. We've communicated back and forth a little bit, not on a really regular basis, but say hey once in a while, you know.
That's cool. The reason I wanted to also call was it's been a while since I've put eyeballs on you, and the last time was both you and Tom at the, well, ties into your whole career, the Haymakers reunion.
Oh, that thing. Oh, yeah. February of 2012.
What was the Hounds were there.
What was that, Biddy Mulligan's?
Biddy Mulligan's, I think.
Yeah.
Is that right, Mike? Was it Biddy Mulligan's?
No, it was at Dirty Nelly's.
Dirty Nelly's. Yeah. Well, some broad's name.
I think I dated both of them. That's all right.
But I forgot about that.
Yeah, that was a great day. That was a lot of fun.
You know who was there too? Was Greg Potter and Kathy Rich, Buddy Rich's daughter, were there. That's the first time I actually met Kathy, and they're going to be on the show here in a week or so. They're going to be live in studio with us.
I just hung out with her backstage at Cheap Trick, at the Cheap Trick and John Bonham show. At
Northerly Island with Foreigner.
Yeah, she was backstage there.
Uh-huh. You were there, weren't you?
Yeah.
Did you see Mitch there?
You know what? I don't know that I did.
He was waiting at the gate with a couple of guys with no neck for you.
That's it. Yeah, I was back there going, come on, bring it on here. What are you doing? It's like...
I keep in touch with Sandy Caulfield quite a bit from Tantrum.
She's a sweetheart.
She is. Absolutely.
Tom's had her on a show a few times. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. The last show.
Well, Tantrum performed that day. That was the first time they sung together in the three of them.
That's right. Yeah. Let's see. Bitch was there. Tantrum. The Hounds. Pez Band.
Pez Band.
Was the boys there?
No, yeah. Dirty Dan was the MC? Co-MC with me.
That's right.
But the boys didn't play. Who else? I'm trying to think.
Wow, that was a great show.
Scott May and Mark Dawson were in a band. I can't think of the name. All Night Newsboys.
All Night Newsboys.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were there. They played.
Wow. Well, thanks for bringing that memory up. I appreciate it. Is that in your book? Is that in your book?
You know, I don't.
Ken?
I don't think we hit that one.
But okay. I will tell you, from my point of view right now, this is my life. Watching Tom and now Mitch talk about all these bands way before me and how cool they were and places that probably don't exist anymore.
Ken, although, missed the heyday. You really did.
Yeah. I caught, and I say this a lot, especially in radio, I caught the death rattle of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Getting into radio in like 94 – and working at Poplar Creek in 94 when it was still – somebody owned it. At the time, Poplar was owned by the Niederlander
Corporation.
And I was working at XRT in the Score when I first got in, and it was owned by Danny Lee. And he sat in the corner office, and we had a lot of fun. And when I hear your guys' stories, I caught the very end of that. A guy that you've both worked with, Jeff Schwartz, mm-hmm. I worked with Jeff for a long time.
Right.
And as you know, I mean, Jeff was one of the guys behind Disco Demolition even.
He was the guy I worked with at like four or five stations. He was amazing guy.
I caught just enough of it to understand what the heck you guys are talking about. So it's a lot of fun. But watching you guys again reminisce about the boys and the Pez Band and off Broadway or all those kind of things, it's a lot of fun.
I think you came up with a great name for a band. Death Rattle of
Death
Fun.
Rattle.
Death Rattle of Fun.
Yeah, they can go on tour with Death Cab and Cutie. Well, Mike,
or
thank
the
you.
Dead Kennedys.
Mike, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Not too much. And Mitch, I wanted to say one last thing. As far as you starting out and being through music and all these years, you got a guy. Are you still there?
I'm here. We're here. Absolutely.
You got an intern over there that happens to be my cousin at the River. Just started out a few months back, Ryan Craig.
Ryan Craig. I don't think. Are you sure he's still there? I think Ryan has moved on and gone back to school.
Oh, he's. You have so many different factions of music out of that station, don't you? There's country too.
Oh no. We're classic rock all the way.
Well, the station's classic rock, but the group is.
Well, the group
we've
got
stations.
A country station. We've got a what'd you call them? A who's modern that? Rock station.
Q Rock
96.7. Star, and then Q-Rock is more hardcore, almost headbanger. So,
all right. Well, Mike, we got to say goodbye now. We got to get to another topic that I definitely want to hit before Mitch has to leave. All right. Okay. Bye-bye. You brought it up, and we got to address it. Disco Demolition. Now, I haven't read that part of the book, so I'm curious because so much has been said lately about the anniversary of Disco Demolition, and everyone talks about the ballpark.
Right.
Nobody remembers our little club in Linwood, Illinois, called Point East, that did the first Disco Demolition, and it was such a big deal that I remember it literally shut down US 30. People was like Woodstock. They stopped their car, got out, and walked. It was oversold inside. The doors were broken off the front door. The parking lot was filled, and people were just partying everywhere.
See, five this police, is the rock and roll
do,
I missed.
Do we? Because I believe we talk about that. Yeah, do we have to send him a check?
Well, we do. We address that part in the book about Point East.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And in fact, we even talk about Point East in a couple of other ways, just about some of the bands that played at Point East that people don't, and I can't remember them off the top of my head now, but there were a lot of major acts.
We did the first Iron Maiden concert in Chicago ever, third in the country with Paul Di'Anno singing on the Killers tour. We had Humble Pie as somewhat of a house band. Survivor, before they were signed, was like a house band. They played about once a month. In fact, thanks to that, I had the opportunity to be the first DJ ever to play a Survivor song from a demo tape on my old station, and it was somewhere in America, I believe.
Okay.
Jim gave it to me on a cassette. Plasmatics, I mean, B.B. King, all those guys played there. But people forget about Point East. Yeah. You hear about Haymakers all the time. What about us?
Point East was a great place. And after it closed, I don't remember how this came about. I was trying to shoot a rock and roll TV show. I believe this was 1982.
Would have been 83.
Maybe, okay.
April of 83 we closed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this was probably right after that. This was probably, might have been fall. But anyway, and we had four or five bands that played. We had an audience. JY came by from Styx. And we shot this whole thing, and it was actually kind of neat. Sadly, the guy that was the kind of the brains and whatever else behind it, shooting it, didn't have the brains to put it together and market it and whatever else, and it never went anywhere. But oddly enough, the show was called Doing the Cruise.
Wow.
And the all night newsboys did a song called Doing the Cruise, as a matter of fact, that they
played there a lot.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Now Mark, of course, is with Grassroots and has gone on to fame and fortune all you guys.
Just saw him not even 3 weeks ago up at the Arcata and had a chance to. He's such an old and dear friend, and we had a chance to reminisce a little bit. He's doing so well with them too. He's the leader of the pack.
Right.
He's pretty unique.
In reference to Disco Demolition, we talk about the Point East thing in the book, but there's also a great story. And again, you say, everybody focuses on what happened on the field.
And of course, that was a bigger event. I'm not saying it's not, but it's just, make us a footnote.
Yeah, no, it's in there. It's in there.
The breadcrumb should lead somewhere.
But even at the big event, when we address it, Mitch was part of it in the fact that he did play-by-play during the ball game with Harry Carey and Jimmy Pearsall, which is just, it's
That's
really
a dream
cool.
Come true.
Bucket list. I mean, it was, are you kidding me? Originally the reason I got into radio, I wanted to do sports and there just weren't any sports jobs. So the rock and roll thing seemed to appeal to a certain extent, which I'm now glad it did. But sitting there trying to explain, to, especially to Jimmy, what was going on. He goes, "These are not baseball fans. These are." I said, "Jimmy, these are sports fans and they're rock." I said, "Let's call them sports rockers, okay?" But you know, the concept was beyond his deal. But just to be able to sit in the booth with right. those two, I mean, Harry Carey. I mean, my God, the guy's unbelievable.
Let's talk, because I know we're getting tight and you have to get on the air pretty soon.
No, I'm actually off today.
So are you really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Took the day off.
Wow. I wish I had that luxury. But
he's got a book to promote.
That's true. I do want to talk about the fact we've talked some great rock and roll stories and radio stories, but this book is also a personal memoir about mm-hmm. your travels and your personal life.
Right.
And let's talk a little bit about that. How hard was it to open some of the wounds you did?
Well, really, the one that was the most difficult, of, obviously, was the death of my son, Spencer. The wives were, they come and go. It's like stations, It's like, well, that one, yeah, I was married. And then over here, but I lost my son, Spencer, 2.5 years ago. And that was, well, that's something that just doesn't ever go away. And it sticks with me. I wanted to express it. It certainly is part of who I am every day. Mm-hmm. But I also thought that if we could express at least some of the feelings and some of the circumstances that I had leading up to his death, and it was a prescription drug overdose, and then some of the circumstances afterwards, that if it could help even one parent or one kid or whatever else, and it's funny, I've noticed that several of his friends have purchased the book, and I'm pleased in the sense that maybe from his death has come some good things, in the sense of some of these guys have cleaned up and maybe gotten a little more straight and narrow.
We're going to talk a little bit on the second half of the show with Dr. Sandip Kapoor. He was Anna Nicole Smith's doctor, and we're going to talk a little bit about the opioid situation in America right now, coming up in just a little bit. So if the drug situation that's out there that Mitch was just talking about is something that impacts you or your family, stay with us. We're going to talk about his experiences, his book, as well as that epidemic that is all over the media now. Mitch, you and I came up during you a little earlier during the drug culture. We mentioned Kent State, and I came up in the 70s, and that was a big part of the industry. And I'm sure you've lost many friends, musicians, radio people, record people. I know I have. How did you avoid the trappings? You mentioned a little bit of dalliances in the beginning.
You know what? It's funny. I was somebody who certainly was willing to indulge in a lot of different things. The one thing that I guess I had maybe other people didn't have was I could say, no, I'm off this weekend. I'm not doing anything this weekend. Mm-hmm. I'm not drinking. I'm not smoking. I'm not snorting. I'm not, And I can remember having guys, when I was PD at the Loop, I had this great big glass table in my living room, and a couple of guys in from New York, record guys, and they're doing foot-long lines off, and they couldn't believe.
Right.
I said, I'm on a purge weekend, guys. I am not doing anything. And I guess I had enough willpower to be able to say, even with that, oh, come on, just do,
Right.
No.
Well, good for you.
And it was. I think that was probably in part when I finally decided to say, I'm walking away from this completely. It's just today's the day. Moving forward, move through the door and close the door behind you.
If you don't come to that crossroad, that turning point, I think we wouldn't be here.
Right.
There was
I agree.
A certain point. I remember the day I said, "That's it. I'm done," and walked away. Never even thought about it again.
Right. Right.
And of course, we see so many other people go by the wayside and get lost in it. What have we not talked about that you guys want to talk about before we leave?
Well, and we've kind of hit on it in the sense that there's so much that we haven't hit on. But Journey, Foreigner. There's a great personal story with Dennis DeYoung in a supermarket.
Oh, Dennis is an old friend. Let's talk about Dennis. You know.
Well, this was fun. This was recently, actually.
Okay.
Dennis doesn't live very far from me, and I've known those guys for 40 years, and he actually has recorded a couple of drops for me where he says, "Hey, everybody, this is Dennis DeYoung, and you're listening to Mitch Michaels doing the cruise." He said, "I get up every day and listen to Mitch, and I can't believe this guy's still alive. It's like some of those kind of things.
Yeah.
He's got a good sense of humor. He does. But I'm in the Jewel right by my house, and I'm walking down one aisle doing something, and I walk by this white-haired guy, and you know, it's like, wow, that could have been Dennis DeYoung's father. It was like, you know, and I'm over, and, you know, and he starts walking towards me, and I'm like, Dennis? And he goes, Mitch. We start talking, and he had supposedly been on the morning show earlier in the week, mm-hmm. and I believe his wife's uncle or somebody had passed, and they were just out of town, gone, and unexpectedly. And I mentioned this to him. He goes, oh, geez, you know, we didn't call anybody. We didn't, you know, postpone it. This was just, you know, a family thing. We had to go. I said, well, maybe you and I can do something. And so we ended up doing he was doing a show like a week and a half over at Star Plaza, as a matter of fact. And so he and I did some stuff on the air like that next following week. And that's also when I got him to record some of those good drops.
I had him, I think, a week after you. The Star Plaza show, it's funny because I do a lot of animal work with shelters. And a lot of my celebrity friends will sign things. We use them for auction. And I had talked to Dennis and Suzanne. I says, yeah, would you sign a few things if I bring some posters and pictures? He said, sure, no problem. So we go upstairs. Well, of course, being a hometown guy, 900 people come to see him and expect to go backstage.
Sure.
Well, at a certain point, I think he had had enough. He's like, okay, you know, he said his hello, shook some hands, and suddenly he was gone. And I'm thinking, wow, where'd you go? All of a sudden, my phone buzzes. He's like, meet me outside by the backstage door. And I'm like, okay, this is really cryptic. So I grab my wife. We go downstairs. And at the Star Plaza, it's kind of a loading dock area.
Right, right.
There's a white car sitting in the shadows, and it flashes its lights twice. I walk over
very
there.
Very clandestine.
I saw that in Eddie and the Cruisers.
And I walk over, and he's like, okay, let me sign him. I got to go. And so I'm really leaning in the car.
Oh, that's funny.
It looks like some kind of weird deal going down there. And Suzanne's laughing, and my wife's laughing. She's like, do you guys know how you look?
The security cameras getting you in the suite. It's like
it was funny, but Dennis is a character.
Oh, he is. He's.
I did an Illinois Entertainer story with him, and I remember the first time I met him, we went to the Outriggers in Lansing, a seafood place. And then we played softball with the heat stroke victims back in the day. Lots of fun. I think we were heat stroke victims about third inning. We had to call the game.
Yeah,
but it was a couple of retired jocks. And Ken, you and I did that too. We played with JY.
We did a great one with JY, the guys from Enough's Enough.
Yeah. Ralph Covert.
Ralph Covert was there. We played
Steve
a lot.
Steve Dahl was there.
Yeah, Brian, was Steve there?
Yeah, Steve played for the White Sox
side. That's right. That's right.
Carlton Fisk, Bill Melton.
Yeah. Ron Kittle.
Ron Kittle.
That was Ron's.
That's turnabout is fair play, huh? Where they got him on the White Sox side.
Yeah. He was the only rocker. It was the Beat Bashers for our magazine.
Was Billy McCarthy there?
Yeah, Billy McCarthy was there.
Yeah.
It was crazy. We had some good times. Brian Middleton was there.
Right? Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But, you know, and that's the thing, you know, again, getting back to the book, it's a lot of that kind of stuff, too, you know. You know, and there's the personal things, you know, you talked about Spencer, the variety of wives, you know, like any good rock and roller, you've got a little bit of a roster.
Been there.
One from column A, one from column B. And
I'm on column three now.
Then there was the blonde column, and I'm done. I'm not going down that road again. So
but there's a lot of names people will recognize, you know, from radio people to rock. To venues and songs and Van Halen and Playboy. And I mean, it's a really good rock and roll book, but it's also a very good personal capsule of Mitch and, you know, his side businesses. And it's just, you know, granted, I'm biased,
let me just say one thing. You were talking about how Ken and I got on and whatever else. As we were doing this, I said, dude, it really needs to be in my voice. It needs to be Mitch speak. And he's done an amazing job of that. I give him a lot of credit and a lot of kudos in the sense that the book really is
your story.
It's Mitch's
my
voice.
Story, but he wrote it in a sense of, and I mean, you know, obviously I was writing in there too and changing things and, you know, going, no, dude, not this. What are you, goofy? It's like, you're smoking some good stuff again when you were doing this? But seriously, he really did a phenomenal, and I'm biased on it too, but But
was that hard, Ken, to put yourself in Mitch's shoes?
You know, I'm going to say no, only because that's how I've written for years. You know, my first book was a breast cancer story from the eyes of it was someone's story. It was through his eyes as a husband and a father going through the breast cancer journey with his wife. I've written media kits and whatnot for artists, George Strait, Kenny Chesney, Martina McBride. And, you know, a lot. That's how I write a lot of times is coming. You have to put yourself in their shoes and speak it in their voice. So thankfully, I had a lot of experience coming into that I, you know, when Mitch and I having 3-4, you know, long sessions, I was able to grab his voice and write in that.
Now, the book, Doing a Cruise, Memories of a Lifetime in Radio and Rock and Roll, is officially out. It's online. Yeah. Is it going to be in brick-and-mortar stores at any point?
Maybe not for a few months yet, but, you know, EckhartPress.com is the website for the publishers, but there's an easier way to find it. All you have to do is go to doingthecruise.com. Mm-hmm. And that'll take you right to a link to that.
You can purchase the book right there.
Yeah, you can purchase the book right there.
And it's a paperback, right?
Yes, it is.
Correct.
Are you going to do a hard copy?
I don't think so.
No, I mean, the nice thing about paperback is we can keep the cost of the actual book down. And that's just typical business. You know, when you start to have to pay more for the product of something, that all gets passed on. So it's a nice paperback. It's a good thick read. There's some great pictures in there. Rock star stuff, family stuff, you know, even like things like the studio jams, which we didn't really get into.
Right.
You know, I mean, Mitch hosted the first, they used to do this thing called Studio Jam where they paired David Bowie and Iggy Pop together. Now, which is.
That was the first one. Yeah. But we had a plethora of artists come through, you know, Foreigner, Journey, Styx, Cheap Trick. I mean, it was just, and we get them up to Mantra Studios. And they would many times just do a live performance and, you know, we'd broadcast it on the radio. And obviously we'd record it as well for playback at some other point. But we really helped break Foreigner because Atlantic had them. The album was out. They had a show at the Uptown that was coming up in about probably 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And let's do the studio jam thing. So they did their whole set live on the radio. People are going, are you nuts? Why would I go pay for the show at the Uptown if I can hear it for free on the radio?
Right.
Well, all this did was bolster interest in the show. The Foreigner show sold out. It was in the Uptown. Was what, 44?
Yeah.
4,500. Great venue.
That's gone now, isn't it?
It's there. It's in such disrepair. I know Jerry Michelson has been trying to get people involved to make it a historic spot and bring it back. It would be such a great place to be able to return to. I have so many amazing memories.
I interviewed Prince there on the Dirty Mind tour when his single was Uptown.
Yeah, there you go.
So I thought that was kind of a nice tie-in. Mitch Michaels has been my guest, along with Ken Chirillo. The book is Doing the Cruise, Memories from a Lifetime in Radio and Rock and Roll. And guys, thank you so much for being there.
Thanks for having us.
This was a blast.
This has been fun. We got to do this again.
We're ready. We're ready.
Anytime.
I love it. Anytime I get a chance
to
talk
a new
rock
book
and roll with the two guys that lived it long before me, and I say long before me because I think you're both a little bit older than me.
Yeah.
But no,
we both still have more hair than you do, though.
No, not really.
That's right.
Got a little more than Ken.
But do we have to write a second book to come back?
We maybe do the extended edition at some point.
Yeah, I think we'll just have to share some rock and roll road stories. We'll do a show called From the Road or something.
That would be
a lot of fun. There you go.
Talk about running from police with Humble Pie. Being there when Wendy O. Williams was arrested or breaking into Debbie Harry's dressing room. I've got some great stories of my own. Ken, we got to write a book.
That would be a lot of fun.
All right. Today in music history, lots of things happened. The Beatles were on tour. They appeared at the Public Auditorium in Cleveland, Ohio. Speaking of Cleveland. During that performance, the fans caused a riot. The police stopped the show, and Derek Taylor had to go on and calm the crowd down before they were allowed to come back. That was in 1964. Pink Floyd released their 9th studio album, Wish You Were Here, on this day in 1975. And a landmark in the music industry, the 8-track tape player was first introduced by the Ford Motor Company on this day in 1965, and it was a big deal. People were trying to special order 8-tracks.
Absolutely.
So lots and lots of fun. And one final tidbit from this day in history. Back in 2004, a sad note, Ramones guitarist Johnny Ramone, who was born John Cummings, died in Los Angeles after a 5-year battle with prostate cancer. And of course, since we are talking with a radio legend, and we are going to pay tribute real quick to the Ramones and Johnny Ramone, let's do this one. It's all about rock and roll radio.
The All-American Half Pound. Sweet, pure beef patty. Lettuce, tomatoes. This is Rock and Roll Radio. Come on, let's rock and roll with the Ramones.